This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's always been a conventional way to get an education. You go to kindergarten, then grammar school, then high school, then college. Then it's off to the workplace. Hope you enjoyed the ride. Watch your step. Have a nice day. But with economic times being as dodgy as they've been over the past 5 years, that convention has been broken, at least when it comes to college.
And I was just struck by the remarkable energy and commitment of these students, often with a real uphill climb.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how the non-traditional student is the new normal. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute teaching old dogs new tricks, young ones too. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. So what exactly is a non-traditional student? According to Mike Rose, a professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, non-traditional students are the key to our economic future. As more and more people drop out of today's tough job market, GEDs, vocational programs, and community colleges are providing these students a second chance at improving their lot. Mike Rose focuses on what he calls this quiet tidal wave of returning students in his new book, Back to School. He examines the crucial roles that community colleges and adult education programs play in American life today, even as budget cuts threaten their existence. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with Rose about how he got started investigating and writing on this topic.
Well, I've been doing this work for a very long time, working with folks who, in some way or another, you know, haven't had the best time of it or the easiest time of it in our educational system. But this new project just really caught my fancy as I was visiting some community colleges here in Los Angeles who serve a pretty poor population, pretty poor segment of our population here in the city. And I was just struck by the remarkable energy and commitment of these students, often with a real uphill climb. You know, they had transportation problems, they had to work full time, they had families to support. And yet they were coming back to school with this real determination to just try and do better for themselves. So that really caught my attention. And then the bigger set of issues that you just mentioned, the importance of these institutions in the society and the threats to them through budget cuts, all of that began to really gel for me.
I want to talk about specifics in a moment, but why do you think these programs, for example, community colleges, often get such a bad rap?
Yeah, isn't it the truth? This is a terrible thing to say in a country that prides itself on being so egalitarian. But, you know, we really do have a status system here in terms of our institutions of higher education. You know, the schools that end up in the U.S. News and World Report top 40 or 50, they're the ones that everybody looks at and takes great pride in. But I think the real action in the United States goes on in the 1,000 community colleges and the thousands of state colleges around the country. This is where most Americans get educated, and it's a shame that all the attention tends to go to the elite schools and the flagship universities. So there is a status system in the country, and I think that's one reason why places like community colleges get such a bad rap.
Given their importance, and as you say, they are a place where a majority of people get their education, why then are they not more on top of the agenda, even when it comes to the states and those funding these institutions?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a complex set of reasons. One we just talked about, but then again, you know, you've got all the various politics and pressures and interest groups at play in each of the states. I will say, you know, in his defense that the president in the last 3 or 4 years has really tried to shine a light on the community colleges. It's interesting, isn't it? He tends to give a fair number of speeches from community colleges. So for their part, I think the current administration is at least trying to underscore how important these places are. But you're right. I mean, they're facing cuts throughout the states, and in some states, like my home state of California, they're facing really significant cuts that are profoundly affecting student access. I mean, again, in California, which is a place that has a huge number of community colleges, geez, Joe, something like close to 500,000 students over the last 3 years have either not been able to enroll or haven't been able to enroll to the full capacity that they want. I mean, that's a shocking number.
The subtitle of the book is Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. What do we know about what people do with that second chance? If successful in going through, what do we know is possible?
Right. So first of all, I think it's really important to say that, you know, our success rate in these schools is not terrific. And there's lots of reasons for that, and a lot of people are trying to do something about it, both within the community colleges and outside. But when people do succeed, when they do make it through these programs, they can either transfer to a four-year school, if that's the route they want to take, or many of them are in occupational programs. They get a two-year certificate or degree, and they move out into the world of work. You know, it's a difficult economy right now, and it still is. And so that affects some of their prospects. But what we know, first of all, let me just say the general picture. What we know, and we know this from Department of Education statistics, is that the more education you get, even given all the problems with the economy now, the more education you get, the better on average your chances are for more income, for better job security, for a better employment future. So that's the big picture. Focusing more on particular people, what I see that's so interesting is sometimes even what seems to us like a failure, that is, someone comes and maybe takes 30 units of courses, but then has to drop out because of family obligations or employment problems or whatnot, that sometimes even those folks, that they get enough extra skill that it enables them to maybe move just one bump up in the ladder. And that may not seem like much, but, you know, if your salary increases by a few bucks an hour or you get a job that has a little more future to it, that can make a difference in someone's life. And then, of course, if you move on and you actually get a credential of some kind or a degree, you get certified, you enter into a job that has some kind of future to it, that can be huge. Healthcare, for example. A lot of healthcare workers come out of our community colleges. Something like 60% of nurses come through community colleges.
You look in the book and call this an argument for democratizing knowledge in America.
Right.
What does that mean?
Yeah, again, the big picture. Something that's so interesting about the United States is that almost right after the Revolutionary War, we've been a country that continually tries to create opportunities for more education beyond whatever formal education someone has. So when you look back, you see the rise of literary societies and mechanics institutes and public lectures. Early unions like the Knights of Labor had a significant educational program. Farm organizations like the Grange had a significant educational program. You know, you got the land-grant colleges that lead to our state universities. My gosh, correspondence schools, university extension, the GI Bill, is an example of this kind of impulse. So we're a country that pushes and pushes, it seems like, for more education, more opportunity. And that's this democratizing of knowledge, to my mind. And what concerns me is that that impulse, which we see, again, in our time with the increasing numbers of people trying to get into college or community college or into training programs or into adult school, that this is being threatened by the austerity measures that clamp down on the budgets of these institutions. I can give you an example here in Los Angeles. The adult school budget, this is a massive adult school system. It serves 250,000 people. That budget was cut to one-fourth of its previous year's budget, and that affects so many people. It affects people who are trying to get job training. It affects people, immigrants who are trying to learn English. It affects folks who are trying to get a GED. So that's the threat, I think, that we have to this kind of continued impulse in our society to, you know, get a leg up, to get a little more schooling, to try and improve one's lot in life.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Mike Rose, author of Back to School, continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1169. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is author and educator Mike Rose. He's speaking to the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new book, Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education.
You said the word example a moment ago, and you give several examples in the book and tell stories of this, of people, of a wide range of people, unemployed, veterans, women who dropped out of school to raise kids. They're looking to go back to school. They want a second chance. And these journeys that they are on, you write, bring up very important questions, very basic questions about how we teach and the culture of education. And it's really fascinating when you bring it to that level.
Right. You know, one of the wonderful things about working with, and I've done a lot of this kind of teaching in my past, one of the wonderful things about working with folks who are coming back to school, of all the different stripes that you're talking about, is that they force you to rethink some of the things that you just assume. So the schools that are most effective in helping these folks make their way successfully through to a certificate or a degree, the schools that are most successful are responsive to them. So just on the level of structuring classes and counseling sessions and all that, you know, do they make them available in the evening or on the weekends? And what about the way they distribute financial aid? Is it flexible and immediate enough? And what about services like tutoring? You know, do they make those services available, widely available? But then what it gets us to is the issue you brought up. And this is what's really interesting about it for me as a teacher. They require you to not just stand up in front of a class and deliver a lecture, right? I mean, it really calls for you to think about what fundamentally do people need to know in order to understand some of these basic principles of biology, let's say, or things that you've always taken for granted in the teaching of writing suddenly are challenged because maybe somebody hasn't had a very good education and they need for you to explain things better or illustrate more dramatically. So what's hugely important in these institutions that are successful is that faculty come together and have some kind of professional development that helps them change the way they teach and not assume things the way they would normally assume them, and to provide a kind of instruction that really is more suited to the folks who are in their audience. And this is where really interesting things happen with education, because when you see somebody who's come in and is having trouble with basic math, and then a year later you see them being able to handle algebra and to move on into transfer-level math courses, and you see the difference that makes in their lives and the kind of understanding that they have about mathematics that they didn't have before, that's a profound thing, and that's what education, it seems to me, is all about.
You write in the book, when it comes to curriculum and teaching, course sequences and requirements can be confusing. Here's a small but telling example. It's not uncommon that the three sequenced remedial writing courses leading to transfer-level English will have non-sequential, seemingly random numbers such as English 68, 25, and 30. The same holds true for reading and for math. And of more concern, little coordinated thought is typically given to how to address the limited skills and background knowledge of many of the students wanting to take academic or occupational courses. How do we make that better?
Right.
Because it seems as though there's an easy fix.
That's right. And boy, I'm so glad you brought that example up, because it's really pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, if you just think about it, if you or I walked onto that campus and we were looking at a catalog and the sequence went 20, 28, 12, 96, there's no way you could make sense of it, right? And the reason that those things exist are usually it's just tradition. You know, a course started and then somebody added another course and then somebody added another course and nobody coordinated the whole thing. And it's just like a bunch of barnacles, you know, on a pier. They build up. And so what it takes, again, this is what the successful institutions do. It takes just looking at all this through the eyes of the students who are on your campus. You know, if for one second administrators and faculty would step back and put on the glasses of the folks who are walking onto their campus, they would see how absurd this is. And so what you see happening at the successful institutions is that they rethink this stuff from top to bottom, not just the sequencing of courses and the numbers, but what are those courses themselves, and are they doing an effective job, and what kind of evidence do we have that they are, and what is it that students really need? I mean, we've been doing something, let's say, this way for 40 years, but is that really what people need, and is there research that helps us think about this in a better way? So the way you make it better is, number one, and I can't emphasize this enough, just standing in somebody else's shoes, you know, putting on the eyeglasses that they have when they walk onto the campus. What do they see? What sense do they make of things? And then the second thing is, how can you rethink a lot of the curriculum and the teaching practices that you've relied on for years in ways that make them really more responsive to the folks who are in your seats?
You do discuss, obviously, you write a lot about those being educated, but you also write about the educators themselves. And you have a quote in the book from one Midwestern community college instructor who says, quote, "It's hard to get the conversation going when we're all teaching five sections of writing," meaning there is such a burden on the instructors themselves. Like any profession, there is a wide range of backgrounds and styles and commitment and competence. But you write about how much of a burden is put on them, which makes it even more difficult to fully engage and to fully educate these students.
Yeah, and you know what, Joe, I'm glad you're bringing that up, because it just occurred to me as you were reading that, I wouldn't want it to sound like I'm just out here to castigate the folks who are trying to do this work, because I've done it myself, and it's difficult and challenging work, so thanks for that corrective. What you're pointing out is, I think, something that's usually important. A lot of the real heavy lifting that is done in the community colleges, and not only there, by the way, this is true, I think, across higher education, is done by folks who are part-time instructors, and they're trying to make a wage by going to two or three different schools and teaching a class here and a class there. So when you've got a lot of basic skills courses in math and English being taught by folks like that, or like the person you're quoting, even if they are a regular faculty member, but they're teaching five sections of writing, as that person says, it's kind of hard to get people together to talk about how to make the curriculum better. And again, this is where I think leadership and smart use of funding and being entrepreneurial about getting funding from outside sources is so useful. And the successful institutions are better at doing this. So what they do, for example, as one vice president said to me, is we just have to create a place on this campus where faculty can come together and talk about teaching. So what is it that administrators and department heads are doing to create the conditions for their faculty to be able to come together and talk about teaching? Can they lighten their teaching load in any way to enable that to happen? What about applying to outside sources, you know, philanthropies or local industries or whatnot, to get a little bit of money to help with professional development? Again, this is what the more entrepreneurial or forward-looking institutions are trying to do. It's not easy. I don't want it to sound like, oh, that's all you have to do and it'll happen. It calls for a lot of work and it calls for a lot of time and commitment. But when you see it succeed, the payoff is just, it's dramatic.
Let us end on that idea of success. When we read this argument for democratizing knowledge in America, our optimism should be where?
You know, our optimism should be in a couple places. One, it should be in really honoring this tradition. I mean, it's who we are. It's what makes us a free society. It's what makes us a society of opportunity. We need to do everything we can do to make sure that institutions like this and opportunities like this continue and continue for the next generation and beyond. That's where our optimism lies, I think, in terms of looking at the big historical sweep. More particularly, you can't help but be optimistic when you spend time on any of these campuses and really get to know people and watch them as they work and find a way to get to school and take care of their kids and do everything else that needs to be done and still manage to, you know, take their history course and take their welding course and get their certificate and maybe transfer to a four-year school if that's what they want. The immense energy and desire that exists in the folks who are doing this is really enough to it just makes you realize what is possible if the opportunity is there for people like that.
Mike Rose is a professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. The name of his new book is Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. So perhaps you can teach an old dog new tricks. Young ones, too. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Does your dog know its favorite toy by name? As Emil Vanderzee, principal lecturer in psychology at the University of Lincoln, reveals, your pet may be using the attributes you least suspect to identify that favorite ball.
Dogs understand that object names refer to objects. For example, in a study by Pilly and Reed, a border collie called Chaser retrieved no less than 1,022 different objects upon hearing their name. But are names for objects associated with the same things for dogs and for humans? Let us first look at what we associate with an object name. In several clever experiments, Barbara Landau and colleagues showed that humans mainly associate names for objects with the shape of an object. For example, they showed young children and adults a U-shaped object, called it a Dax, and then asked their participants to select a Dax from several size, texture, and shape variations. Participants selected variations in texture or size, but not shape variations. This shows that people have shape bias. They generalize the name of an object to other objects that have the same shape. Do dogs also have a shape bias? In our research, we repeated the experiments carried out by Landau and colleagues with Gable, also a border collie. Having freshly learned the word Dax, Gable ignored the shape of a Dax and focused on its size instead. In order to make sure that this wasn't a one-off occurrence, we carried out an experiment with a different set of objects and a different name. But again, we found that for Gable, an object name referred to a particular size. In addition, we discovered that when Gable knew a word for a longer period of time, he tended to associate an object name with an object's texture. Gable has shown us that object names are associated for him with bite size and feel of texture, whereas object names are associated with object shape for us. Although more research is necessary in this area, Gable has shown us that there is something different in a name for him than for us.
That was Emil Vanderzee of the University of Lincoln. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.